From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, we revisit an ugly past and hear the stories of African slaves.
My heart throbbed with grief and terror so violently that I pressed my hands quite tightly across my breast, but I could not keep it still.
Then we listen in on people chanting from the heart. And what's this sound? Take a guess. We'll have the answer to this week's mystery sound from Audiograph. That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. This is the week of Juneteenth, the holiday commemorating the day all black slaves in America were officially freed. On June 19, 1865, Union soldiers captured Galveston, Texas. They brought news that the war had ended to slaves in Galveston who hadn't heard. Those last slaves were freed more than 150 years ago, but slavery scarred American history. Its horrors are exposed in raw form at an exhibit currently showing at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. The audio installation Slave Narratives presents the true first-person accounts of Africans enslaved all over the world, including Cuba, Nigeria, and the United States. I visited the museum earlier this year to tour the exhibit with community associate Emily Storer. The room is kept purposefully dark, meant to replicate the dungeons that slaves were kept in before being shipped off from Africa.
Okay, let's go in.
Okay. We eventually went to Havana.
There's nothing on the walls or in the room, just the bench I'm sitting on and the sound of the slave testimonials booming from the speakers above. We first hear from the writings of Juan Francisco Manzano, a slave taken to Cuba who aspired to be a poet.
I bought ink, pens, and penknife, and some very fine paper. Then, taking some of the bits of written paper thrown away by my master, I put a piece of them between one of my fine sheets and traced the characters underneath in order to accustom my hand to make letters. My master was told how I employed the evenings, and once he surprised me with all my writing apparatus. He advised me to drop that pastime as not adapted to my situation in life, and that it would be more useful to employ my time in needlework. In vain was I forbidden to write, for when everybody went to bed, I used to light a piece of candle, and then at my leisure I copied the best verses, thinking that if I could imitate these, I would become a poet. And a poet I became.
Community Associate Emily Storer.
The diversity of the narratives that we have available in the Slavery Passages installation really highlights the overall diversity of experiences of people who were enslaved. There are people who lived in the 17th century, and there's people who were alive up through the 1930s when their stories were recorded during the Great Depression. There were people who were Muslim, there were people who were Christian, there were people who were neither. There were people with families and people who were all alone. There were people who were literate, who published their own narratives, and then there were people who had to rely on other people to get their story out to the public for them. So it's really incredible, just with these 9 stories, how much diversity there is, and then that also reminds us that the stories that weren't told, the millions upon millions of stories that weren't told, were just as full as all of these people's stories. We just don't have the opportunity to be able to have a firsthand experience with them.
This narrative by Mary Prince is about the day she was sold off from her family at age 12.
Our mother, weeping as she went. She called me away with the children, Hannah and Dinah. And we took the road that led to Hambletown, which we reached about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We followed my mother to the marketplace where she placed us in a row against a large house with our backs to the wall and our arms folded across our breasts. I, as the eldest, stood first. Hannah next to me, then Dinah. And our mother stood beside, crying over us. My heart throbbed with grief and terror so violently that I pressed my hands quite tightly across my breast, but I could not keep it still. And it continued to leap as though it would burst out of my body. But who cared for that? Did one of the many white bystanders who were looking at us so carelessly think of the pain that wrung our hearts? No! No!
What are some of the, like, I really have to kind of take a breath after that experience, the dark room, mm-hmm. and very heavy material, mm-hmm. being heard. What are some of the reactions from people that have kind of come out of this room? Was everybody okay?
Some of the stories, it's almost too incredible to be true, I think. And I think for younger audiences who aren't as familiar with the material, it almost seems like something out of a horror novel, maybe. For example, the story of Harriet Jacobs, who published her own narrative. She was trapped in an attic for 7 years. She wasn't able to stand. She didn't see light for 7 years. It's incredible to imagine a human being going through that. You couldn't write a story like that.
Harriet Jacobs was hiding in the attic after having escaped an abusive mistress. This shows that the process of escaping was long and arduous.
Season after season, year after year, I peeped at my children's faces and heard their sweet voices with a heart yearning all the while to say, "Your mother is here."
And the incredible thing is not only did these people live this experience, they survived slavery. Everybody whose narrative is featured in this exhibition eventually gained their freedom in one way or another, and they became functioning members of society. It's incredible the survival that's deep within all of these narratives, I think.
Thanks to Emily Storer for her tour of the exhibit Slave Narratives. It's on display permanently at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. This Sunday, the museum is having a family-free day celebrating Juneteenth. Details are at kalw.org. It's also where you can find more of the museum's slave narratives. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Sitting in a room with powerful first-hand accounts of slavery booming from the ceiling and bouncing off the walls is quite an experience, not only for the ears, but for the heart. And that brings us to the audio files, our series of conversations with the most creative people working with sound.
You hear that?
Can you hear me?
It's incredible.
You might be wondering what that sound is. Well, here's a hint. It's the sound hearts would make if they could sing. Let me explain. This was recorded as part of the Garden of Memory Experimental Music Concert, which happens every summer solstice in the most peculiar of places, the Chapel of the Chimes Columbarium in Oakland. It's a historic building designed by the great architect Julia Morgan in the 1920s. It's built sort of like a maze, and it contains thousands of urns with people's remains. During the concert, this place for honoring the deceased comes alive with dozens of experimental musicians and hundreds of visitors from all over the Bay Area. So, what's it like to be at a gathering of audiophiles in such a unique space? KALW's Martina Castro and Seth Samuel were there, and they brought back this sonic portrait of the Garden of Memory.
Okay, first off, Seth, I think we should tell people how this music festival found its way into a resting place for the dead.
Yes, let's do that.
It turns out that it all started with a bathroom.
I was writing a story for the East Bay Express about best bathrooms of the East Bay.
That's experimental pianist Sarah Cahill.
She's got a show on KALW.
That's right. It's called Then and Now on Sunday nights. Sarah wanted to see what the bathroom at the Chapel of the Chimes was like.
For her story about bathrooms.
That's right. It's actually supposed to be quite nice. So about 15 years ago, she wandered into the Columbarium.
I heard some music coming from somewhere in the building, and it was a very, I have to say, sensuous experience wandering around thinking, oh, it's this way, and making a turn and then encountering a little, you know, cage of lovebirds and a little fountain and a pool, and I thought, oh my God, what is this place?
So that question led to the creation of the Garden of Memory concert. It's kind of an experimental music festival.
And wandering is key to experiencing this festival. We went with a bunch of KLW people, actually, and we lost each other immediately. Because there was no direction or order to the event. People just followed their ears toward echoing sounds all around them.
We followed some familiar sounds.
And also some that were less familiar.
Playing a trumpet and had certain tubes connected to different notes in the trumpet so that the tubes would make those separate notes come out of different parts of, I don't know how to explain what I just saw.
Now remember, we're not in a concert hall or a conservatory. We're in a columbarium.
That's right. We're walking around in and out of rooms with names like Benevolence, Court of Quietude, and Garden of Eternal Wisdom.
Some urns look like books or works of art. It gives the impression of being in a library.
The walls are covered in perfect squares. Each is etched with a name and set of dates. And each square leads to the remains of a real person.
David T. Turnbull, 1855 to 1932. Ellen A. Turnbull, 1858 to 1935.
And for the Garden of Memory concert, the Turnbulls are joined by musicians.
Everywhere.
I love how much discovery there is in the building that everyone's wandering through, and it's low commitment.
Eli Warchafter is a violinist, and he's one of the younger musicians here.
He says it's rare to see such a diverse crowd at a new music concert.
Often people are afraid to come in and listen to new music. What's it going to be? People can discover it's quite wonderful.
And experiencing it in what's basically a mausoleum really makes it more profound in a way. But Seth, you know, you and I kept getting separated.
I know, and it was kind of scary.
It was! But at one point we found each other at this installation where sound artist Larney Fox wasn't playing a traditional instrument.
Yeah, it was like this massive, strange guitar slash music box thing.
Bigger than a person.
Yeah, way bigger. There were strings pulled tight across the floor, and a series of motors were spinning feathers at various rates to pluck those strings.
The plucking and the motors turning are what's making this oceanic heartbeat of a sound.
Remember when you asked Larnie this question?
What would you say is more important, how it looks or how it sounds?
I don't know. Would you rather be deaf or blind? You know?
Blind.
Yeah, I guess radio people would, huh?
Yep.
Well, I found his actual answer to be quite interesting.
Let's see, how it looks or how it sounds. What's important is the relationship between the two. For me, this is it's very easy to look at what's happening and see how the sound is generated. And that's not true with a lot of new music. There's a lot of things where there's somebody sitting with a computer. They're creating something live, but you have no idea how it's happening. I really like the materiality of it.
Exploring the relationship of how this all looks and sounds is exactly what Garden of Memory is about. Which brings us to the part of the night where you, Seth, took me to my favorite sound.
Have you been upstairs?
No.
There is something amazing.
Let's go.
Upstairs that I think is going to be... It's going to blow your mind.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited.
Oh, my God. You are so excited.
I know. Well, can you describe where you took me?
Yeah. So the sound was coming from the top floor atrium where a group of people were in a circle and they were singing. They had their right hands on their hearts and their left hands were on the backs of the people next to them.
It's called the Heart Chant, and it's by experimental composer Pauline Oliveros. Members of the Cornelius Cardew Choir, based here in the Bay Area, were mixed in with regular people who came in and out of the circle without ever breaking the sustained chant. Jed Holtzman, one of the choir members, explained it to me.
Right now there's about 22 people doing the Heart Chant, and the vast majority of those people just walked up and read the instructions, which are very simple, basically to think about healing yourself in the world and basically make breath tones, which is to sing any tone on your breath with the syllable ah.
People in the circle looked transfixed. I didn't want to get in the way, but Jed motioned for me to get in the middle of the circle with my big microphone. It was like entering audio recording heaven.
Happens over the course of a couple of minutes is that you start to actually listen with your body.
That's my colleague Casey Miner, who took part in the Heart Chant for almost 20 minutes.
You're drawing your tune from the people around you, whether that's a harmony or note you're singing in unison, and your breath rises and falls with theirs, and it almost feels like the music swells or falls according to when one person moves in or out of the circle and takes a deep breath and begins singing again. It's very beautiful.
The bells.
Yeah, the bells. They signal the end of the night. And just like that, this magical excursion came to an end.
People seemed pretty euphoric as they emerged from the Chapel of the Chimes.
Yeah, except maybe Ron Banks.
It was the first time and was kind of surprised.
He came from Sunnyvale to hear his son-in-law play. I found him sitting on a bench outside and asked him what he had expected coming in.
Basic music. This was just different for me.
Yeah, so you wouldn't say that you listen to what they call new music.
Yeah, no, it was interesting, and I'd recommend it, even for people like me who just, you know, like Frank Sinatra.
It's sort of like an invention that sometimes it works, but with a slightly different combination, it doesn't work.
Again, that's pianist Sarah Cahill, who founded Garden of Memory. She says the magic of the night is not in the sounds or the musicians, the audience or the place, not even the date of the festival. It's a combination of all those things.
And you wouldn't want to hear the experimental music somewhere else necessarily. You wouldn't seek that out. But it just strikes you the right way and you want to sit and listen.
That's pianist Sarah Cahill, who, by the way, hosts the KALW program Then and Now on Sunday nights. And we were guided through the Garden of Memory concert by KALW's Martina Castro and Seth Samuel. The Garden of Memory is put together by New Music Bay Area and Lifemark Group Arts. You can experience it yourself tomorrow night. Details are at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound. The idea for this one came from a listener named John Baum, who wrote and asked us to record at the north end of the Golden Gate Bridge. So KALW's Ray Sue Sussman took her microphone out to the bridge to record some sounds. She also talked with Mart Bailey, a 90-year-old San Francisco resident who actually saw the Golden Gate Bridge being built and who walked across it the day it opened in 1937.
We were allowed to go over it before the cars were. So my sisters and I and our friends walked over it. And one of our friends' father warned us to walk in step so that we didn't topple the bridge, I guess. I don't know what his... He didn't want us to go. He was afraid it was going to fall. You know, everybody had different emotions, but it was beautiful, and we kids walked over it, and we walked in step, as I recall. It was just a beautiful day, and we didn't realize how important the bridge was. We were too young to really realize, but... it was just the thrill to be there. We realized, I guess, history was being made. You could see Alcatraz Island from there, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful ocean, and I still get a thrill going over. I guess you could tell I'm a true San Franciscan.
Thanks to Mart Bailey for that answer. The Golden Gate Bridge is such an iconic part of the Bay Area that we thought this week's sound would be an easy one for people to get. But guess what? We stumped you. No one got it right this week. So this week, we're going to send a KALW t-shirt to the listener who sent us the original idea for the sound. Congratulations, John. For the rest of you, there will be another contest next week. We love hearing from you, and we want to give you a head start on next week's sound. Here's a sneak peek. What is that? And where is it from? If you think you know, call 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you may be next week's winner of a KALW t-shirt. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Lisa Carmack, Ben DeLuca, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daphne Matsiaraki, Stephen Short, and Eva Sonsin. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. This music is from a work that was commissioned by and for the Yerba Buena Gardens Festival. It's called Letters to Home, and it's being performed for the first time this Saturday by the Trans Global People's Chorus. Darren Johnston stopped by KALW to tell us a little bit about what went into creating this special performance.
Filled my life with joy and hope.
I commissioned 8 letters from various immigrants, and
chopped up the letters to create songs. I wanted to be able to tell these people's stories. I think that's a powerful thing, is to be able to honor these people through music. At the end of the day, I think that the job of an artist is to dig deep and find empathy in ourselves and then communicate that and hopefully create more empathy for more people.
You can see Darren Johnston and the Trans Global People's Chorus this Saturday at the Yerba Buena Gardens Festival in San Francisco starting at 1 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.